I'm Gavin Hennigan, and this is the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show, where this week I am super excited about the guest that I have with you. He's a former drug and alcohol addict who cleaned himself up and has gone on to do some phenomenal things. First of all, his career as a commercial diver working on oil rigs across the world is interesting in itself. But then he's gone on to do some absolutely amazing events, ultramarathons across the Arctic, you know, across Canada, climbing mountains well into the death zone. And later this year, he's going to take on probably his biggest challenge yet, a solo row across the Atlantic. Gavin Hennigan, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Breffni. Great to be here.
I'm super excited about the next 40 minutes or so as we have a chat about all that you've managed to achieve. But first of all, I want to talk about, and we're going to talk loads about the row across the Atlantic, because that's kind of happening in the next 6 months.
Absolutely.
You must be super excited about that.
Yeah, very excited, very scared, a lot of different emotions, but yeah, it's definitely the right path I'm on.
Because when I did my adventure around the planet, worst case scenario, I fall off the bike. Do you know what I mean? That's the same here as it is in Thailand or Australia. You're on terra firma, but you, if something goes wrong, you really are talking life and death situations.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm going to be pretty much on my own out there for up to 3 months, you know, so it's a big, big challenge. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, we're going to talk about that in plenty of detail later on in the show. But first of all, I want to rewind a few years back to your early days, specifically your teenage years in Galway. Tell us a little bit about Gavin, the 16-year-old.
Yeah, so this is obviously really important to tell the story and how I ended up wanting to row across the Atlantic. And I started off as a normal teenager, I suppose. I was actually quite into sport in school. I was big into swimming. But then when I hit 16, things kind of changed for me a lot, because I knew that I was a bit different to everyone else in school, different to all the guys and the girls in school. At the time, I barely knew it, but I was gay, you know, and that was my kind of crux, as I say, in my life. But then on top of that, I just started experimenting with alcohol and drugs, which I kind of really went down pretty hard, pretty fast, because I had a bit of an addictive personality, shall we say, but also not being able to deal with who I was. I basically just went straight into that, and it was like a duck to water, really, you know.
When did you realize that was the reason behind it? Like, what was the first experiences, say, in terms of being homosexual? How did that work for you?
Well, you know, I think this is we're talking 90s Ireland here. You know, I think homosexuality was only legalized in 1993 in Ireland, so there's no way of being out, really, or anything like that. And I suppose at 16, you wouldn't dream of coming out. I mean, I know kids probably do it nowadays. So it was just this sort of secret that I, you know, had to absolutely keep. And there was no way I was going to tell anybody. That was kind of like the number one rule. And there was a lot of energy put into that for myself. And my first experiences of that was basically, you know, meeting men at nighttime in like a cruising area, which is like basically down Salt Hill in Galway. And that was kind of that would have been the first experience I had. You know, there's a few places like that around, you know, a lot of people know about them, but they're not so much used anymore, because you know, people use the internet and different apps for meeting people, and obviously there's you know the gay bars and stuff like that, so it's a lot easier to meet people nowadays. But back then, obviously, you know, it makes me sound very old at the moment, but it was very much undercover, and it's, you know, something that I was wanting to hide from everyone, you know.
So how deep into that hole did you get?
Well, you know, with all that, you know, like trying to deal with who I was, kind of 16, 17, you know, as I said there, I started using the drugs and the alcohol. And I just really went into that because I didn't really know what to do. You know, I didn't really fit in because of the being gay. And then I got a lot of acceptance through when I was drinking and stuff, and people used to think I was a bit crazy and a bit mad, you know, and I suppose I was, you know.
Do they still think you're a bit crazy, a bit mad?
They absolutely do, in a different way, you know. But yeah, I used to, you know, and I used to drink hard and use a lot of drugs, and I used to enjoy that sort of, I suppose, there was a bit of approval there, you know, like, you know, Gav's a bit crazy, blah, 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 you know. But at the time, I suppose I was really just hiding who I was, you know. And, you know, just things just spiraled out of control. You know, I ended up dropping out of school the year after that, you know, and I was in just the beginning of Leaving Cert. You know, I just didn't have the head for it. I wasn't able to concentrate. Got more into the drugs and got into trouble in Galway. And then it ended up kind of going over to Holland for a few months and living in a squat there and kind of working on a farm for a few months, and started using a lot of drugs that I thought I'd never use, you know. Started tried heroin and crack over there. At the time, I'd been doing quite a lot of ecstasy. I was quite big into the sort of dance scene and the, you know, the sort of rave scene at the time. So that was kind of a big thing for me as well. And yeah, just one thing led to another. I ended up coming back to Ireland, getting in more trouble. I left again, and it was just, you know, just a real mess of a time. And it was really kind of at the coalface that I really didn't realise what was happening with my life at the time.
What was the relationship with your parents and your family like at that point?
Yeah, it was pretty strained. I mean, like, I came from a broken home. My father was an alcoholic as well, you know, so the apple didn't fall far from the tree in my case. And I was, you know, I had a big resentment towards him. You know, I kind of hated him really as a teenager because he was never really around. You know, one of my earliest memories as a child was actually, you know, kind of trying to defend my mother and my sisters from my father, who was kind of drunk in the house one day, you know, kind of like get back sort of thing, you know. And, you know, that was my upbringing, the sort of craziness of living with that. And that's, you know, that's no way a child should live, but, you know, it happens in a lot of homes in Ireland, and there's a lot that goes on behind closed doors. And that kind of was the way I grew up. And then, you know, I my mother basically raised us, you know. My father wasn't around that much. So that was a tough thing for me. As I said, I had a lot of anger towards him, and that really fueled a lot of my alcohol and drug use. So just between that, you know, dealing with that I'm gay, you know, not really knowing my place in the world, you know, just by the time I hit that, you know, late teen years, you know, I was a recipe for disaster in a lot of ways. So, you know, just I ended up, as I said, just got in so much trouble and just things spiraled more and more out of control.
Where did that end? What was the absolute bottom of that hole when you eventually got there?
You know, the bottom of the hole was like between the ages of 19 and 21. You know, I left Galway. I had gotten in quite a lot of trouble, owed a lot of money to different people, trouble with the law, stuff like that. And I moved to, well, went on the run practically to London, to Essex, and just outside of London, ended up living in a flat there with another Irish guy. And, you know, it was just a bare bones flat with nothing in it, in a small room with a mattress on the ground, and the curtains blacked out it was blacked out windows with black bags. And, you know, I just remember waking up in the mornings, you know, I hadn't been working at the time, I was kind of on the dole over there, and you know, I just wake up and it would be dark in the room, and it could be light outside, and I used to just get stoned and go back to sleep, you know, just hiding from the world, you know. And I used to hear the letterbox going, it might be some sort of bill or something, and I just was like completely overwhelmed by that. I just couldn't deal with it, you know. And with that sort of alcohol and drug addiction, I think you just want to hide away from the world, and I just was so content to just not be, you know, out and about. And, you know, there was nothing glamorous about my, you know, there was no real great parties or you know, it was just, it kind of was down and out in the end. It was a lot of, like, you know, by myself, using by myself, you know, in a dark room.
It sounds like kind of those TV shows with cops that we hear about, where they go looking for the drug dealer or whatever, and they walk through the bodies laying all over the place in squats and squalor. Was it really like that?
Yeah, like, it was literally a small flat and there was nothing in it, because if you rent an apartment in the UK, there's no furniture usually, and, you know, you'd have to spend, you know, money on furniture. But, like, to me, you at the time, I wouldn't spend money on furniture because I'd be spending it on drugs and alcohol, you know. So to me, that didn't make any sense at all. So, you know, as I said, I had a mattress, and, you know, I think we had a small TV, and it was on like a box, and then we had like two beanbags, and that was kind of, there was no like table or anything in that, you know. So it was a dive, you know. We lived, you know, we just didn't bother cleaning up. It was just living in squalor, you know. So yeah, looking back, it was not a nice place. And I remember even in the bathroom, I had a, you know, the mirror was, I used to headbutt the mirror, you know, because at the time I didn't really realize that I had a lot of self-hatred, but, you know, I did, because I used to kind of just have this anger and just like headbutt the mirror. And actually, you know, I still have like scars on the top of my head there from, you know, because I used to end up, you know, getting bits of glass in the top of my head. And yeah, you know, it was not a nice place, you know, to be there.
So what was the end of that? How did you get yourself from there back to normal?
Yeah.
What most people call normal life.
So it was just a kind of, you know, at the time I went home for a funeral. I was about 21. I just about managed to get home at the time. It was just changing with all those passports and having to travel. I had a driving license, or no, I didn't have a driver. I had some other ID. I just about managed to get home, but I knew I had to get a passport then to come back, you know, and I never really got it. I ended up kind of just coming back to Galway and then getting back in with all my old friends and getting in more of the same trouble. And then my mum kind of confronted me because I'd been living at home. I think one morning she came back and I'd arrived home at 11 o'clock in the morning. I'd been out the night before and there was like a friend of mine there and we'd like, you know, gotten into the drinks cabinet and we were like just basically having a little party at 11 o'clock in the morning from being out the night before. And she arrived home and she's like, "What's going on here?" And you know, she basically booted my friend out and she's just like, what are you doing with your life, you know? And she really kind of confronted me and hit me with it pretty hard then and then, you know. And I suppose I did stop at that moment because you know, she'd been through a lot of that with my dad, you know. He'd a very long history with alcohol abuse and gambling and drug addiction himself, you know, so she'd seen it all. And you know, she was watching it happen to her own son. So this was, you know, obviously a nightmare for her. And at the time, I'd never really considered myself the same as my father because I'd always used a lot of drugs and he was an alcoholic. I don't know what I was thinking there, but I thought because I'm a drug addict, I'm not the same, but I was exactly like him.
Looking back, you can see that was you, the exact same person, effectively.
Exactly,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, she was kind of like, you know, you're just exactly the same as Paul, you know, exactly the same as your dad. And, you know, it just really hit me at that time, you know.
And was it the comparison with your dad and the memories of what had happened at a younger age that kind of flicked that switch for you?
I think so. You know, it was a bit... at the time, you know, it's hard looking back because I was really at the coalface of addiction. And, you know, people do ask, like, what was the moment, you know, that it did happen? And, you know, it's very hard to identify because it's such a blur in a lot of ways. There wasn't a lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of thinking going on. It was just like, okay, I need to, you know, get to the next party. I need to get the next drink, get the next drug, whatever it is. So there isn't a lot of, you know, stepping back and really taking a look at life. You know, it was just, you know, I was in a vulnerable place at the time. My mum hit me with some of that information, you know, or her own feelings. And I did, you know, and then she said, "Would you consider going to a rehab, you know, or getting some sort of help?" And I was just kind of like, well, yeah, maybe, you know, because I knew, deep down, that I wasn't really going anywhere. I just, you know, spent 2 years in London, not really doing too much, you know, getting fired from jobs because I was, you know,
not showing up,
you know. I did start a sort of an apprenticeship as a bricklayer and, you know, I'd literally get paid on a Friday evening and, you know, come Monday morning, I wouldn't have a penny left. I'd be like jumping the train just to try and get to work, you know, and trying to like ask for a sub, you know. It was just you know, in a lot of ways, it was just a real mess of a life, you know. And then, as I said, when I came back, then, she put it to me to try and get some help. So at that point, I kind of said, well, yeah, I'd consider it, you know. So I think, you know, ultimately, like, it was up to me, you know. She knew that she wasn't going to make me do it. I had to decide for myself. So I really did. I did stop and think then, like, what's going on here? Like, what am I doing with my life? And would I be able to change things around? Because deep down, I always knew that, like, I was powerless. I knew that I hadn't control over what was happening with the drugs and the alcohol, that it was just, it had taken over and I just couldn't stop, you know? So, and I always wondered the whole time I was doing drugs and alcohol, that I just was like, I wonder, will I ever be able to stop? It was a big kind of question mark.
Did you want to stop?
Not early on, definitely not. I wanted to get out of the trouble that I kept getting in, but I kind of wanted to have a manageable, you know, experience with the alcohol and drugs. But I don't think that's ever, in my experience, that has never been possible. I could never really have one, you know. I didn't really see the point in having one beer. I never even really liked the taste of beer. It was like, I just need to get hammered, you know. I had to get hammered, I need to go out, and I just, you know, and it would be like a binge for me, you know. So,
okay. Rehab, you decided you would avail of your mum's offer,
yeah,
and get yourself clean.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was brutal, yeah. I think at the time, yeah, I spent, I went to one in Bushy Park in Ennis, just outside Ennis, and I spent about 4 or 5 weeks in there. And it was tough. It was, a real hard look at yourself. They, you know, they do like a group therapy, and they really get into the bones of your alcohol and drug addiction and really try and make you realize the sort of damage that you've caused, you know, because I think as an addict or an alcoholic, you know, you never really, as I said, you're at that coal face, you're never realizing the damage that you're doing, you know, and like there was a lot of stuff obviously that I'd done in my teenage years, you know, I stole from my mother, you know, and like I trashed the house one time and she was away, like, you know, a lot of like stuff like that.
Things that a lot of people in that situation do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Like to hear a drug addict had an issue with stealing things is not exactly surprising.
No, exactly, yeah. But then again, like obviously realizing that's, you know, not acceptable behavior really for somebody who wants to be in normal society. So it's just kind of the process of trying to, you know, just trying to make them realize sort of what's been going on, you know, because it's very hard at the time to be able to take that step back. And that's what they kind of do in the rehab. And then they bring in your family and they do like a group therapy with the family session and stuff like that. So it was a tough few weeks, but I kind of did hang in there and I just decided I'd give it a crack anyway. And I suppose looking back at the time, I always knew that if I went back drinking, I never really would have fitted in because of being gay. I always kind of felt like an outsider anyway in my life. So I kind of knew that I wasn't going to find a solution through alcohol and drugs, if you get me. It wasn't going to make me a whole, you know, W-H-O-L-E. It was like, you know, to cure the H-O-L-E inside me, you know. So I just said, look, I'm gonna give this an honest crack at the moment, you know. And I finished out the rehab and then I came out, and then I actually ended up going back. I had like a relapse then over the space of a couple of months, because it was a lot of information at once, you know. It was a lot of, I kind of got bombarded in the rehab and I wasn't really ready for the outside world, and it was kind of like a new beginning almost, and I kind of slipped back into OAs again. But then I also, when I did, I had a kind of a head full of information about sort of addiction, and it almost ruined the alcohol and the drug experience, because that's the point
obviously. How do you go from, I suppose, the relapse, you got clean again, and then how do you get to become a commercial diver working in various parts of the world?
Yeah, you know, so with that relapse, and I'll just tell you a little story. I'd relapsed a third time, and I was with another guy who'd been in the rehab with me, and I was completely down and out. I was like, look, I felt like a complete failure, because, you know, I'd gone to this rehab and then I'd come out and I wanted to try and get some sort of clean time, you know. I wanted to be able to, you know, put some days behind myself, you know, and it just wasn't happening. And, you know, he said to me, you know, he'd been clean for a while, and he just said, look, I don't know how many times you're going to do this. You could do this another 10 times. You could do it until, you know, it gets a lot, lot worse. You know, you could end up completely on the streets, you know. And you just have to decide yourself, you know, how bad do you want it to get, like, you know, and how bad you want it. And you know, everybody's rock bottom is different, you know. Like my rock bottom is rock bottom. Some people have to go out and use alcohol and drugs for, you know, 20, 30 years before they reach theirs, you know. But for me, luckily or unluckily, through you know, being gay and having like whatever, all the stuff inside me, and then using the drugs, I hit mine pretty quick. And after that, you know, I really decided to, you know, put in a big effort, you know, which was just really doing the basics and trying to stay clean and do like the group therapy sessions that I was doing in Galway. And then I kind of put a plan together to stay there for, you know, just the time being, not to take off, because I kind of had this thing that I'm going to go traveling, and, you know, or
recipe for disaster. Yeah, when you've exactly. Got those sort of influences. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I basically put one foot in front of the other for 2 years in Galway, and, you know, I actually went back working on the building sites for a while, and then I got fired from that job because I just couldn't concentrate. My head was kind of a bit melted, and then I got a job in an outdoor store, and I'd started surfing at the time, which was amazing. I'd actually was actually on the dole for a period, and a friend of mine who was also getting clean, a good friend of mine, John, who's still clean today. The two of us are like within a week of each other. We're both nearly 14 years clean and sober.
Congratulations!
Yeah, cheers. And he had he was on the dole. I was on the dole, and he had he'd saved up a bit of money because he'd sold his decks. He was a DJ, so he wanted to like get out of the, you know, the dance music scene. So he said, look, I want to go surfing. I've got, you know, got enough money here. He had a car. He said, I don't have money for a board, but I don't have money for a wetsuit. And I said, well, look, I've got a bit of dough money here. I'll buy a wetsuit. And you've got the board, and we'll head down to Lahinch for a surf, you know. So we head down to Lahinch, and this is, you know, the middle of October, like, you know, raining sideways, big storm. And we're down, you know, giving the surfing thing a go. And, you know, the two of us just kind of like, we're only probably a few months clean at the time, but, you know, we're just keen to have a go at this sort of surfing thing, because it was just kind of starting in Ireland. A lot of people were getting into it at the time, sort of early 2000. And, you know, so he gets in with the board and the wetsuit, and I'm sitting in the car rattling away in the wind, and he goes out for an hour, and then he comes back in, we swap out,
you have to get into his wetsuit. Yeah, that sounds disgusting.
Yeah, and I think he had pissed in it as well, so it was,
well, at least it was warm. It's exactly. Kind of nice of him.
You know, and then I get in the water, and it was just, things really changed for me at that moment, because I just, I was in this cold water in, you know, down the hinge in the middle of the storm, not really getting any waves, because it was my first time, and I was just flapping about, and, you know, the wind was blowing, and it was just a very raw experience, and I was just, it kind of ignited something within me, you know, so, like, that just happened. After that, things just kind of started happening, where I was just like, okay, I want to go surfing now, and then, you know, we started going, kept doing more, going surfing again and again. And then I got a job actually in an outdoor store in Galway, and I was kind of, you know, they sold surfboards and stuff like that, so I managed to get a board then, and like things just started happening. And it was all basically because I'd stay clean, you know, and then because I'd found something to sort of, some sort of purpose, and that was basically to go surfing, you know, whatever it was, you know. So like I you know, as I said, something was kind of igniting in me then, and it was just like a desire to do that sport, you know, and it was just a passion, and it was there, and it was a drive, you know. So from there, that just kind of took over with my life, and I spent the 2 years in Galway surfing, and I decided I was going to go to Bali after 2 years being clean. I'd saved up a little bit of money. I was working in the outdoor store, and then I was delivering Chinese at night time. So I was flying around Galway in this little Fiat Punto. Like, I'd learned to drive in that time as well. I couldn't drive before that. I'd spend, you know, the evenings working, and then at night time I'd drive up to Eastkey in Sligo, or drive down to Lahinch at like 1 o'clock in the morning, sleep in the car, wake up at 5, go surfing. So it was just this really full kind of cool life that I just basically landed in, and it was.
See,
just,
then that sounds scary and crazy to certain people as well, I'm sure, listening, that you purposely drive to what is effectively the middle of nowhere. Like, Eastkey is a nice little town, but it's, you probably park down on the beach at 3 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning to get up to go surfing at that ridiculous hour.
Yeah.
What's so special about surfing that it has to be done at that crazy time in the morning? Well, is it the peace and quiet?
It's actually, because the main problem with surfing is the crowds, you know, because only one person per wave, it's kind of the rule. So if you're there early, you'll get it to yourself, and that's what I wanted. I wanted, you know, to have a quiet surf, and I didn't really want to be involved in a pack of surfers. So and then it's just, I think it's just nice to be up first thing in the morning like that, you know, and it is peaceful and it is a beautiful thing. So like, I've got this sort of thing to keep me, you know, you can imagine, like, people ask, like, how did you stay clean? And I said, well, I had that because, you know, I had no interest in going out. I'm not sitting at home twiddling my thumbs going, I wish I was down the pub, or I wish I was, you know, out drinking with the lads, you know. Yeah. I was like, right, I got to get up at whatever time to go and get these waves, because this is like my buzz now. This is like, this is my kick. This is amazing. This is, you know, and Ireland has so much to offer, and this is, you know, Ireland's got some of the best surf in the world, you know. So it was a huge discovery and a huge adventure, really. And I suppose, you know, that's what my life has been since then, since getting clean. It is an adventure. And I've always just, from then on, whatever it is that I've tapped into, I've always just kind of kept true to myself in that regard, that it, you know, if I try surfing, or if I try anything and I have that sort of spark, I think, well, I have to go towards it, you know. And that's kind of what I did with the diving, like I'm just about to go into, you know. It was kind of just suggested to me about, you know, commercial diving when I went out to Bali. I surfed there for a couple of months, and then I went on to Australia on a working holiday visa. I was 23 at the time, and you know, someone said, oh, I think it was my sister, you know, she said, I know this guy, is it like a commercial diver? And I didn't even know what it was at the time, and I said, well
most of our listeners won't either. What exactly is commercial diving?
So commercial diving is just in working in construction work, basically underwater. So it can involve anything from, you know, sort of working civil construction inshore, you know, bridges, dams, stuff like that, harbours, piers, to the offshore, to the oil rigs, the oil fields, the wind farms and stuff like that. So I basically got the idea again. I was like, wow, that sounds amazing. I'd totally be interested in that.
Sounds kind of dangerous.
Yeah, diving is inherently dangerous for sure. You know, I don't think humans are really meant to be underwater, especially doing kind of construction work in murky waters for sure. But again, I just said, wow, this sounds like a cool job. I definitely want to give it a go. And at the time I was in Australia. And so there was a school right there in Perth where I was, because Perth's kind of like an offshore town, you know, because they've got a lot of oil there in the west of Australia. And I basically got a loan and decided to go for this this job as this course as a diver. And, you know, I'd gotten a bit of advice from a couple of people, and it was not to do it. Initially, I was like,
I wonder why.
Yeah. Well, they just said it was a tough industry to crack and there isn't that much work at the time. And I just didn't listen, you know. I had it in my head that it was what I wanted to do. And I just had that mentality. And I just decided I was going to do this course and just see what happens. And I went for it. And luckily, while I was in school, Hurricane Katrina had happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and that kind of obviously destroyed a lot of the oil rigs up there, and there was a huge boom in diving after that because people had to go there to work, and it left a lot of vacancies in that region of the world. So I came out of school and walked straight into a job, and I was offshore not long after coming out of school, which is amazing. And it's just, yeah, things just fell into place in that regard. I just kept getting work, and I ended up moving to Bali. Then I lived in Bali for a few years. I was working on the oil rigs and the boats around Southeast Asia and India, and just had this amazing life where I'd spend 2 months working out in the South China Sea, and then I'd come back and spend a month surfing in Bali, you know.
See, that sounds kind of brilliant. So why would you pack all of that in and go back to Galway?
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose I've spent so many years, you know, I spent all this time traveling, but I've never really felt like I'm happy in the one place. I've always been a kind of person of the world or a bit of a nomad. And I suppose being at home has helped me a lot with just kind of being a bit more grounded, because I have some family at home, and it's where I'm from. And living in Bali is fun, and it's an amazing place, but it's a pretty hard place to live, you know, a full-time citizen, or even to, you know, own property is a nightmare over there. And just like the basics, it's tough to get to the basics done over there. It's challenging in a lot of ways. But, you know, I've been single for, you know, quite a period now, and I just decided, yeah, I prefer to be kind of closer to family and back in Ireland for the time being. And yeah, so that's kind of the last couple of years I've been back, and also I've been working in the North Sea over the last few years as well. So I kind of moved up into a bigger company in the North Sea, which is a better place to work for safety for a diver, you know. So it was just kind of made sense to be closer to that, obviously, than living in Southeast Asia.
So you're back in Galway, but the wanderlust hasn't quite left you. So you've spent the last whatever number of years still going around doing some crazy and amazing things around the planet. Specifically, the high altitude mountaineering is interesting. So you mentioned, now I'm going to probably butcher this name, but Ama de Blam.
That's right.
Ama de Blam, I'm impressed myself. In Nepal, somewhat about 6,800 meters, which is not quite Everest standards, but it's pretty high. Like 6,000 is kind of the point where it starts getting life-threatening every time you cross that barrier. What was that experience like?
Yeah, that was incredible. I was out there last year, and for anyone who doesn't know, Ama de Blam it's actually on the way to Everest. It'd be in the Khumbu Valley, and it's one of the most beautiful mountains in the world. It's a technical high altitude peak. It's a lot harder than like Everest. You know, there's vertical ice pitches of rock, and I went out there with a moderate amount of climbing experience, with no high altitude experience. The highest I'd been was Mont Blanc. Just under, just under 5,000 before that would be the highest I've been. So, kind of took a chance, because a lot of people would have said,
maybe, yeah, I think a lot of people would have said, don't do this.
Yeah, go, you know, maybe do something a bit higher and less technical first. But I suppose
So vertical ice is effectively exactly as it sounds. It's a vertical wall of ice that you got to climb.
Yeah, yeah.
With no technical experience.
Well, I mean, I've done some, but I see, the thing is, when you take stuff to high altitude, it exacerbates everything. It makes everything just that much harder.
So less oxygen. Yeah. You're carrying everything on your back, so you're under pressure. Well, you've Sherpas and stuff with
you.
We've
got Sherpas with us, yeah. So obviously climbing in Nepal, you know, 99% of people don't do it with Sherpas. So, you know, you've got a lot of help there. There are fixed ropes there, but I mean, it's still, you're still climbing these pitches, you know. So, it was definitely one of the toughest experiences of my life. You know,
do you not think maybe at that point that's where you take people's advice? Do you have a problem with taking people's advice?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Does that worry you going into the Atlantic Row?
No, it's something that I am working on, because I've actually done a psychological evaluation with a company in the UK called Peak Dynamics, who are run by ex-military guys who are, you know, help people in business and also people in extreme environments on their decision making. And I've done this psychological evaluation. I've come up on the self-driven scale. I've kind of scored off the charts. But then when it comes to things like trusting other people, trusting other human, I undervalue human relationships, and I'm considered a maverick in that I don't listen to people.
Yeah,
so.
You kind of sound like a bit of a maverick. That's why I asked the question. That for me is one of the things, like I said, when I did my cycle, and yeah, it was a long adventure and it was fraught with danger of certain elements, but there wasn't a real danger that I would die because of the environment I was in. Like, yeah, it was very hot in certain places and very cold in certain places, but the actual fear of death was never because of the environment. But you're going into an environment where literally from the first 20 minutes out, there is a chance that of catastrophe that's outside of your control. A freak wave, wind, storms. You can't control that. What backups have you got in place for that?
So with,
I'm not trying to talk you out of it, by the way, but I'm just trying to see that you've seen through the full picture.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, okay, for example, if someone said to me 5 years ago about rowing the Atlantic, I would have said the exact same thing as you, you know. I would have had the exact same reaction. But looking into it, like reading some books, talking to some people, it's a very, very doable and manageable thing, you know. But there are a lot of systems in place. Like, obviously the boat is a hugely important, you know, the type of boat. Like, the boat that I have is a self-righting boat, so if it capsizes, which it probably will at some stage, it will get flipped by a wave, it will pop back up again. You know, I have a life raft on board. If I need to abandon my boat, I'll be able to get into a life raft. You know, I have a personal locator beacon, I have an EPIRB, have a VHF radio, I can get in contact with other ships nearby. I have a survival suit, I have 90 days of food. You know, this isn't... You know, a lot of people kind of would write me off as some extreme adrenaline junkie kind of thing, and I 100% I'm not. I'm going out into the Atlantic to row for potentially 90 days. It's going to be one of the most boring and mind-numbing experiences you could possibly imagine. If I was an adrenaline junkie, I'd go and take up wingsuit jumping, and I'd jump off a building or base jump, and you know, I'd probably die a lot quicker, you know? So, you know, there is a lot of thought that goes into my stuff. In one sense there is, but in another sense there isn't. So I'm trying to always find that balance. For example, I will 100% spend a lot of time thinking and obsessing and asking questions in regards to every little bit of equipment that I would bring with me. But if it's not something that's going to save my life, I'm probably not too interested. Do you know what I mean? I'd be more interested in everything to do with my boat than I would be in, you know, somebody's story about, you know, their mortgage or their savings plan. You know, like, my immediate, you know, interest is my boat and my safety, you know, and not sort of, you know.
Well, it's in your interest, exactly, because yeah, ultimately nobody cares more about your own safety than really yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe your mother, but because I'm speaking from experience.
Absolutely.
So you've done things that people would consider dangerous or risky in the past. So I'm thinking the ultramarathons that you've done in Canada over the last 2 years, 500 kilometers earlier this year, 560 kilometers last year. That's a massive distance. How long does that take to run that? Because for me, that would take probably a year. That's running like a couple of miles a day. How long does it take you to do that? You're probably going to come back and say something like, 2 days.
I think the 561 took me 7.5 days, and then the 500 took me 5 days. So I got a lot faster since last year. So it's basically 100 kilometers a day over 5 days. So it's not a lot of sleep, maybe an hour, 2 hours sleep a day, and kind of nonstop. And yeah, like I really enjoy pushing myself in that sort of realm, and that's kind of where things have led with getting into the row. And that all stems from the diving, you know, because like working on the oil rigs, I've gotten into the deep diving, which is, 200 meters. And to dive to 200 meters, we have to live inside a saturation diving chamber, which is a small chamber that you spend 28 days living inside of. And then you get out of that chamber into another chamber called a diving bell and go down to the bottom and get out and go to work. So you're in this small enclosed space, living environment with anything up to 9 guys, usually 6, sometimes 3, and you are in there 24/7 for 4 weeks at a time, and then you don't see the light of day. You're down at 200 meters, working in the dark. So like that's been my life for the last 10 years, and then in between that I'm either climbing or I'm snowboarding in Alaska, or I'm on trips in Antarctica. And that's really just what interests me. That's how I entertain myself. I always want to try and push it. And with the ultramarathons, it was the same thing. I knew that I could basically go out there and suffer because of the sort of upbringing I had through the alcohol and drugs. I've seen some dark places in my own mind, and I've dealt with a lot of my own demons. So it doesn't matter how bad things are going to get. I just know that when I'm in those environments, I'll be able to deal with it. I'm more myself in those environments than I am sort of anywhere else, because I'm not thinking about things. I'm just reacting in the moment. I'm just about the survival or whatever it is. Like when I go out into the row, like I did with the ultramarathons, and also another very long expedition I did in Siberia, where I walked across Lake Baikal, which is 700 kilometers in 17 days. You go out there and you turn into a different person. You just become about everything that you have, your equipment, and surviving and moving forward every day. It's like you just morph into a completely different person. And I just think that's an amazing experience to be able to sort of push yourself into that realm and overcome it,
Specifically, the row interests me.
Yeah.
Because having done my own cycle and having had to fund my own cycle,
yeah,
that's the challenge inside of it. The actual physical end of it, there's probably dozens of people or hundreds of people who could do the physical actual row. It's getting the dedication and the commitment to get the boat, to get the funds to buy the boat, to get the funds to buy the food, to have all the safety stuff in place, and to promote it as well like you're doing here today. That's the hard part. It's the logistics, not the actual physical side of it. Because anybody who gave themselves 6 months to prepare and train could do what I did in terms of the cycling aspect. 30,000 kilometers in a year and a half is actually quite slow. Most people could do it faster than I did. Mm-hmm. But sticking at it is the hard part. And that's kind of where I wonder about you. How do you fund it? And how do you have that mental resolve to keep going when things get tough?
Yeah, you're dead right. I totally agree there with everything you said. It's funny. When I was crossing the lake in Siberia, it was a day-to-day expedition where I was going 12 hours a day, and I'd have to, get up at 4 in the morning and melt ice and snow for 2 hours to fill my flasks, and then I'd have to break down my camp, and, it's like minus 30 degrees out, and, I'd have to pack everything up and get everything in my sled. I had a sled that weighed 60 kilos. I had, all my food and everything for 3 weeks, and then in the evening, I'd have to, find a good campsite, set everything up again, and it occurred to me that the actual walking, the running that I was doing was the easy bit. Once I had everything packed away, similar to you, once you had everything on the bike, you were sorted and you were moving, that was the easy bit.
Yeah, by miles.
It was all the bits in between, and all the organization that goes into it, everything. And that's where I'm at the moment is probably the hardest part, which is, trying to get the funding. I've fronted the money myself, I was coming close to, sort of getting into buying a bit of property there, last couple of years, and I was thinking about doing some sensible things like that.
Forget it. Going to go off and roll the Atlantic instead.
Yeah. So I had a rush of blood to the head, and just, things, the oil industry quietened down big time last year, and I kind of got lost my job actually. So that coincided with me thinking, well, do I dare do something as bold as this? And then I just was like, absolutely, you know. And you know, I decided to go for it. And I think this is really, really key for me in my life, you know, because I never, when I started to be a diver, I never set out to make money. I just was like, this sounds like something cool to do. This is fun. This is like an adventure. I want to go for this. And then I ended up making 250,000, you know, pounds, British pounds a year, you know, over the space of a few years, you know, working in the North Sea. And, you know, I was like, had mortgage and saving plans, investments, and I was doing all sorts, and I was thinking, you know, building, and I need to, you know, buy property now and all that. And then I just thought, you know what, this isn't edgy enough for me at the moment. This is too secure, and this is what I'm doing. I'm investing in myself. I bought this boat that costs like as much as this,
a car,
more than a car. We're talking like €60,000, you know, carbon fiber. And
was it custom built or did you buy it?
Custom built, yeah.
So you can't even sell it afterwards, really?
Well, I can definitely sell it. It's called a concept class boat, because there's not many of them. Most boats, they're like traditional ocean rowing boats, which are kind of like modified for obviously from something like a small rowing boat, you know, like a Curragh almost, you know, over the years to like have a cabin and stuff. But these types of boats now, they look like a spaceship. I've been driving around and
I've seen pictures.
Yeah, people are stopping me everywhere I go. There's just my sticker on there at the moment. I'm hoping for some investment there from some companies to get some good logos on there. But yeah, it's, as I said,
in terms of, because we're sitting in a room where my bike is actually on the wall behind us here, and it was stolen. I got it back, thankfully.
Yeah,
but is it a thing that even if you succeed in crossing the Atlantic, which I have no doubt that you will, but if you succeed, or when you succeed, you probably will never want to sell that boat.
Yeah, I mean, most...
€60,000 would come in handy, but...
Most sensible people, most normal people say to me, oh, you know, they want to know about the resale value. It's quite funny, you know, I know the type of person I'm dealing with, and the first thing they ask me is like how much it is, because that's the first thing in their mind. And then I meet somebody like who's a fellow adventurer, and they don't care how much it costs. They're just thinking, wow, how are you going to do this? Yeah. Like, what's involved? You know, they're not asking questions about money. They're just thinking, how are you going to get this done? You know, obviously the money's important, but it's more about the adventure for me. And that's kind of where I'm at as well. I'm thinking, well, I've invested in myself by buying this boat. What can I do afterwards?
You mentioned your salary though, and obviously the job you were doing is fraught with danger, so it's well paid and well recompensed.
Yeah.
So you must be in a position where if you chose to, you possibly could pay for this all yourself.
Well, I'm going to be completely broke by the end of this if I do that.
Okay.
I'm going to have no money.
No money saved. Would it be worth
this? This is my life savings.
Would it be worth it if it was?
Yeah. I mean, look, obviously, there's not a day that goes by at the moment where I'm thinking to myself, wow, I should have, you know, maybe bought a house and just kept working. But then I go and do a school talk and I tell these kids about some of the stuff that the adventures I've been on. And like, I'd see the smiles on their faces and the inspiration that they take from it. And I think to myself, well, yeah, I am on the right path, you know, like, because look, I am obviously doing all this stuff because I am super driven and I want the adventure and I want the challenge. But I'm doing my best, which is hard for anyone who's a little as self-obsessed as me to be able to make it about other people, you know. So, you know, through, you know, some fundraising for charities in Galway and like with the school talks, you know, giving back and trying to inspire people to get out there and do stuff, do more with their lives, you know, and not just play into the narrative that we have to stay in our jobs, stay in the same jobs and work, you know, the same job for X amount of years until we get a pension. And then what do we do? Twiddle our thumbs, because that's the narrative that we were told, you know, like I've been okay up until now. I haven't really, there's not a day that's gone by that I haven't wanted food. You know, this isn't the world that we live in nowadays. It's not hand to mouth, you know, so we can do a lot more than we think, you know, but I think a lot of us are, you know, people do think that they have to, you know, just stay with the security of whatever it is, their bank account or their investments or whatever it is. And you know having said that, you know, I'm not married, I don't have kids, I'm in a position to be able to take more of a gamble in my life, and that's what I am doing, you know.
I think it's admirable that you're prepared to take on what most people would consider absolutely crazy, but I think Now, I wouldn't put myself in the same class as what you're about to do, but I think knowing what I've done and the work that went into it behind the scenes, I think, fair play, I think the hardest part of this is getting to the start line. Once you're on the start line and you're just, all you have to do is row, this is going to be plain sailing, literally. Although it's not, but it's compared to what you have to do to get to that start line, the very, very best look. I'm guessing, identifying parts of me in you, I'm guessing this isn't going to be the last thing you attempt.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, if you'd said to me, you know, a few years ago that about rowing the Atlantic or doing one of these things, I probably wouldn't have had the belief, you know, and that's the core thing for me at the moment, is that it's the belief to be able to do something like this, you know. And a lot of people out there wouldn't have the belief to do a lot of different things, you know, and this is part of my story where I came from. I came from a very, very low self-esteem place, you know, like that guy living in this flat in London, not being able to deal with like the mail coming through the door, you know, to somebody who's driving around with a boat that I'm just learning how to reverse in a trailer, which I'm not very good at the moment, you know, to get my head around all this equipment.
You don't have to do that when you're on the road, on exactly. The water though, so it's fine.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, it's just taken all these years, and it's been a huge stepping stone coming all the way up to this row, and it's all about the belief of being able to do something. So, you know, this, I won't say the sky's the limit, but you know, there's definitely things that I'll definitely want to do after that. You know, I want to go back to Antarctica. You know, crossing Antarctica would be a huge thing to do. And as an adventurer, it's just an epic challenge. You know, and then, you know, I'm half thinking about trying to row back home next year, because I'll have the boat in. I'm rowing from the Canaries to the Caribbean, so I'll be rowing the Atlantic from the Canaries to the Caribbean as part of the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. So my boat will be in Antigua, and then I'm thinking, well, what do I do with it then? Do I ship it back to Ireland? Do I sell it? Do I send it to San Francisco, roll across the Pacific? Do I get it?
Pacific's a bit wider, by the way.
Definitely wider, yeah.
from San Francisco over, particularly, I start in Vancouver, maybe, and head for Russia.
Yeah.
Much, much easier that way.
Yeah.
Listen, Gavin, we do finish the show every week by asking the same question. And that question is, what can the listeners of this podcast do for you? If you had one question or one ask, what would it be?
Just follow along the adventure, and that would be the main thing at the moment, just to keep an eye out for everything that I'm doing on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Solo Gav, SOULO Gav, and then I'll have my website live very soon, gavinhennigan.com, and yeah, just, you know, look, I suppose just talking about what I do, I suppose, you know, people say that, you know, that my story is inspiring, and that, you know, that people are looking for like inspiration. But I think people need to inspire themselves. I think if you go out and do something, I've always inspired myself. Every time I go out and do one of these adventures, that's where I get my ideas to do more stuff. That's where I find my inspiration, you know. So I think the big thing is that people need to inspire themselves by doing these things, by doing whatever it is, you know, big or small, it doesn't matter. And just kind of living life a little bit more boldly, you know. It's not always about the, you know, the sort of hiding away and getting out and doing stuff, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Gavin, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this week, and the best of luck with the row and everything that comes from that and after that. I'm sure it's going to be a very exciting 12 months for you over the next 12 months. Of course, if you listen to this podcast and you're interested in any other conversations that I've had with people, some similar to Gavin, who've done some amazing things, but definitely people who will interest, inspire and motivate you to do whatever it is you want to do in life, you can check out all the other back catalogue of the podcast on breffnyearly.com. It's been my pleasure to have you this week, Gavin. Thank you very much, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks, Breffny.